From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a man named Joe Perez went through police training in Prince George's Police Department in Maryland. This was many years ago. He thought the training was heavy-handed and focused on training new officers to feel like they were going to be at war with their own community. He felt that the training pitted the department against the people that they were hired to serve. Now, Perez said that safety matters. For officers who are about to become, well, for prospective officers about to become police officers, he says, yeah, you've got to learn how to be safe in your job. But he said there was an obsession with treating it like a warlike mentality. He didn't like it. He was never comfortable with it. He became Captain Joe Perez, and he served at the Prince George's Police Department. He is now the president of the Hispanic National Law Enforcement Association. And in a conversation with Brookings last year, Perez said that heavy-handed policing permeates police leadership, and it starts with training. He says, with the focus obsessively looking at safety and war, he said police training tends to pit officers against their communities. And now he says it's not that he wants an abolition of police. It's that he wants a change in the culture of police. That's part of the debate that's happening around the country. How do you reform police? Can you do it in significant ways without really sort of tearing down and starting over? We've seen it in Minneapolis following the killing of George Floyd, where some dramatic changes were attempted starting this summer. We see communities across New York State having to come up with their own plans for reform as a mandate from Governor Cuomo with an April deadline. The governor says he wants every community to put forward their own plan for reforming police or they're not going to have state funding. So what do we do about this? There are different proposals in this community already, and some of them are going to come from just this hour. You're going to hear from United Christian Leadership Ministry. And as we do that, I want us to keep one other thing in mind. We're against the backdrop of some of the events that happened last Wednesday, less than a week ago. Just this morning, video was released of people who participated in the riot at the Capitol last Wednesday being arrested in airports. There was a lot of screaming, a lot of anger, people shocked, surprised that they would be arrested for going into the Capitol and participating in that riot in which five people died. And one man is being held on the ground and arrested, and he screams, "You're treating me like a black person." Amazingly telling moment. In those words, honest whether he intended them to or not to be, about where we are and where do we go next. Let's bring in the team from United Christian Leadership Ministry. Reverend Lewis Stewart is the president. Reverend, welcome back to the program.
I'm glad to be here, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
Reverend Wanda Wilson is the team leader for United Christian Leadership Ministry. Reverend Wilson, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thank you for having me as well.
And Frank Starpoli is team coordinator for UCLM Police Reform Proposals. Frank, welcome back to you.
Oh, thank you, Evan. Good to be here.
Reverend Stewart, I want to start with that video I think it shocked but didn't surprise me when I saw a man held on the ground in an airport being arrested and yelling, "You're treating me like a black person." What does that say? What does that say to you, Reverend?
That says to me that, number one, that everyone knows that how black people are treated unfairly and in an oppressive manner in this country by the police. Number two, white folk don't even want to be treated like this, and somehow there's the feeling of white privilege. Oh, don't treat me like a black person. I don't deserve this. I'm better than that. So that shows you that we have to change police culture and the way black people are perceived in this nation. That's what it tells me. It's very deep. It's very telling. And it shows that we have a problem.
Yeah, and Reverend, I want to clarify a point that maybe doesn't need clarification. I don't know, maybe it does for some listeners. Some listeners are going to hear this and say, well, come on, not all police treat black people differently. Not all white people think they deserve to be treated differently. And that's true. But what we are talking about is a culture. So we're not talking about in every individual. We're talking about the kinds of elements of culture that are currently present and pose an issue, as Captain Perez from Prince George's Police Department in Maryland was talking about with Brookings. So it's a culture issue. And and Reverend, I know that you not only have respected friends in policing, but you are not someone who has said in the last year that you want abolition of police, are you?
No, I'm not for that. I'm not for the defunding of police nor the abolishment of police. I am for the reallocation of resources so that we can improve how police do their jobs and how they treat people of color. And that's going to take, Evan, as you say, a dismantling of the police culture as it is presently constructed. And that's why I agree in your prologue with the remarks from Captain Perez. We need to change police culture from one of a warrior culture to one where they see themselves as servant protectors. And that's why for so long, police have focused on use of force rather than de-escalation tactics. That's why they have focused on arresting people of color in misdemeanor offenses and crimes rather than some type of pre-diversion alternatives. And so when I look at police culture, I you're right in the sense that it's not every individual police officer that treats black people in a certain way or brown people in a certain way. But the police culture is what dictates how black and brown people should be treated. And that's what I find oppressive. That's what I find racist. And that's what I find offensive.
Reverend Wilson, when we look at what is required of communities across New York State in terms of reform proposals by April, I mean, different communities are having their own debates about what to do with this. Before we kind of really wade through the specifics of how to do this, how urgent do you feel that this moment is to try to get something right and sustainable?
I believe that this is very urgent, right? Something that we have to do right now, especially in light of what has happened at the U.S. Capitol, in light of what we know we are receiving messages that there are violent protests being planned from January 16th through the 20th or the 21st, where we are receiving the news that there will be violent protests or, you know, violent actions taking place at each capital in 50 different states. This is something that, you know, the reforms can no longer wait. We have to get these things implemented in place and utilized as well by police, different police agencies.
Mm-hmm. Frank, you and I have talked on this program about how you see white advantage, different treatment of people based on background, based on the color of their skin. How did you see the events of last Wednesday and maybe some of those remarks that I referenced in the video where a man is saying, "You're treating me like a black person"?
Well, when you said that, Evan, I had not heard that report about his comment, but I flashed back right away to videos of a woman named Peggy McIntosh, who has been around for years, does all kinds of workshops with white folks. And what I've seen her do at times is stop, ask the audience, who are mostly white people, how many of you would be okay with being treated the way black people are treated in this country? She asked that question. She's never had anybody raise their hand because we know it. Well, you know, we're aware. We're conscious, even if we'd rather deny it. There's no question that I have advantage. I have protections by the color of my skin. And all of the systems around me reinforce that, no doubt about it. And that's not just conjecture. That's proven over and over and over again in research about every major system, about healthcare, about finances, about housing, about education, about justice. Every system exhibits the same kind of discriminatory practice even if people say they don't believe it should be that way.
United Christian Leadership Ministry has a set of proposals which we're going to be working through this hour. But before we do that, let me grab our first phone call just from a listener who wants to weigh in on these subjects and get the thoughts from the panel. And that's Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I'm very curious to hear what folks think about the following. I've had this thought ever since Daniel Prude's murder. I watched the video very carefully, and apparently the officers followed their training, theoretically. At least that's what we've been reading about in any articles about it. Nazi Germany, what I remember, if my memory is accurate, is that people who said they were just following orders in the trials afterwards, that was not an acceptable rationale. Their behavior was found to be cruel and inhumane, and that there is a higher law than just following the orders, which in my mind, following training is the same as following orders. So it would seem to me the same could be said for example, the police who acted inhumanely to Daniel Prude, even though in theory they were following their training, but their training was cruel and inhumane. So I would just like to hear what folks think about that.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. Reverend Stewart, I'll start with you on that.
Well, I think, and thank you for your comments, Jane. I think you're right on target with that. The police have always treated black and brown people differently than white people. And certainly we see that in glaring focus at the nation's capital this past Wednesday. I would dare say, and it's been posed by commentators on the news, that if this was a Black Lives Matter movement, the protesters would have been clubbed, would have been shot, would have been arrested right then and there. But instead, the white supremacist protesters, they were not actually taken seriously enough. The guards or the Capitol Police were caught off guard, and the fact is they just treated them with kid gloves, and so this type of bifurcation or schizophrenic treatment of black and brown people as opposed to white people has always existed in our nation's history. Again, it's a part of cultural and systemic racisms, which really have dictated police policies and practices.
Reverend Wilson, what do you think? If you're there, Reverend, make sure you unmute. Oh, we lost her. Okay, Reverend, if you're back there, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we had you lost, Jen. I think we got you back. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay, is it for Pastor Wanda?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, I just got reconnected. Sorry about that.
Okay, we'll make sure we're all squared up with the connection there, and I'll just ask Frank to also jump in with some thoughts on what we just heard. Go ahead, Frank.
Thoughts on which part?
Yeah, maybe? And Jane's call, just regarding, you know, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, the difference, it was fascinating to see that the police department, the RPD, looked at the videos, the body-worn camera footage, and they determined that there was nothing wrong with that. No police officer was disciplined in any way. Nobody was suspended. Nothing at all. Actually, we would never even have known about how Daniel Prude died if it had been up to the RPD, because their PSS, their professional standard section, passed on any kind of discipline. So it's only because of the body-worn camera program, which UCLM was vital in getting in place, that we knew about it. But once that video footage reached the community, there was a totally different understanding of what went on there. It did not matter what the policy was. People immediately said, this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. So that becomes an argument for some of what we're advocating, which is a monitoring in many ways of police action. One of the ways that we are currently doing it is we've had an agreement with RPD to monitor that body-worn camera program. And the Monroe County Sheriff's Office is talking with us now, and we have their okay to say this, that we're talking about the same kind of monitoring program with them so that there's more transparency, there's more honesty, there's more community viewing of what's actually happening.
So let's talk about the specifics then. And Reverend Stewart, let me just ask you to take us through what exactly you want to see done. We've heard from the Police Accountability Board, and we know that there is a lot of work already going on. So let's be specific. From UCLM, what changes can we make? How quick can you make them?
Well, here's the thing. We don't know how quick we can make them. I think change takes place over a process, and a process takes time. We have several proposals that we've worked on. There are more than that in our bank, but we chose to look at about five of these proposals, and I'm sure Pastor Wanda and Frank can chime in and talk about the specifics. First of all, what we are proposing is a community public safety interview committee, which would be responsible for interviewing police officers and for recommending whether or not they are hired. And so we would look at getting some citizens trained at the police academy, but also trained in interviewing techniques. And so that when applicants apply for the police force, after they have had their a background check, and a writing test done, and a physical agility test, and a psychological, they will therefore appear before this committee. And this committee will interview them and ask them questions to ascertain whether or not they would be a good fit for policing the community. You see, we talk about community policing. This is true community policing, because here we insert civilian oversight, as it should be, into policing. The second proposal is a racial justice and education and training curriculum. Usually when cadets go into the academy, they only get 5 hours, and those 5 hours annually are devoted to diversity training, sexual harassment, and another type of training. What we're mandating this time is 40 hours of experiential training and education in the history of policing in this country, and how policing impacts the lives of Black and brown.
We lost you for a second, Reverend.
Yeah, I did too.
Okay. So hey, Frank Starpoli, I'm hearing you. Our phone system's a little hiccupy right now, and I just lost Reverend Stewart while he was talking to us about that. So what we're going to do is we're going to reestablish with Reverend Stewart. Frank, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Reverend Wilson, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so let me ask you about a specific proposal that Reverend Stewart just made here. He says 40 hours of experiential education on the impact of policing on Black communities. Reverend Wilson, do we have a sense for who can do that kind of training? Who is qualified to teach and train in that way?
Sure. I believe we have community. We have people right here in the Rochester community that would be able to do this type of training. It's a training that we are asking for that is based around, that would start with the foundation of policing, starting with going up back to the United States Constitution, Article 4, Section 2, starting with the Fugitive Slave Clause, going through, you know, citizen police patrols, arming of white worshipers, the Fugitive Slave Act. We would have incorporated in the curriculum, you know, viewing of films such as Birth of a Nation from 1915, you know, teaching on sundown towns, and then leading and going up to giving a historical background on the Rochester Police Department, talking about the leadership, talking about the Locust Club. having some conversations and some community interaction around police relations in Rochester, you know, viewing different types of films. We'd have them view the 64 film of Rebellion that was done right here and produced by someone here in Rochester. So there's definitely the resources here to do the curriculum and to teach it as well.
Okay, and I think we've got Reverend Stewart back. So when we talk about 40 hours of experiential education and training, the likes of which Reverend Wilson just described, Reverend Stewart, some listeners might think, well, don't police know this stuff? Aren't they trained in this already?
No, they don't know it because, listen, I was a chaplain in the New York State a correctional facility, and you had to have certain hours of training, and you would have someone stand up before you, and he would be a corrections officer, and he would just read something out of a manual, out of a book, just so that you can get your hours in. And that's what they usually do. We're looking at something that's much more direct, much more experiential, that's going to impact people not only intellectually, but also psychologically in the way they view other people and the way they treat people. We want to really impact policies and procedures. And so presently, that's not going on now in law enforcement. We need to increase this from about 5 hours to 40 hours a week. We really need to bring forth a training in terms of the problems we have in our community right now and how we can overcome them.
All right. So what else is on the list then for you, Reverend, going down the list of possible reforms? Yep.
De-escalation training. De-escalation training, instead of focusing on use of force, we have an equal focus on de-escalation. Usually when police are called to situations or incidents in black and brown communities, the police sometimes have a tendency to escalate a situation by the way they talk to people. They talk to people in a disrespectful way. They will yell. They will scream. They will say things belligerently, and this is all part of the warrior culture. So we're looking at how you can talk with people without escalating a situation until it becomes a violent confrontation. And then there's the body-worn camera program that Frank just spoke about. Usually RPD, the Rondo Quick Police Department, the Sheriff's Department, and also Brighton Police Department, they all have body-worn camera programs. But what we want is citizen involvement relative to monitoring all of these body-worn camera programs, and we feel that the Greece Police Department should have a body-worn camera program too, as well as the Webster Police Department, because body-worn camera programs, they make the difference, and there are certain benefits to them. And then finally is pre-arrest diversion programs relative to nonviolent offenses, and instead of incarcerating a lot of young people, let's have some alternative directions in which they can go to instead of putting people in jail and hence developing mass incarceration.
All right.
Those are our proposals.
Reverend, just to compare and contrast a little bit, you know, when we talk to the Police Accountability Board on this program, they are calling for mental health specialists to essentially go with officers to certain calls and handle it as much, some of these calls, many of the calls, as much as they can without armed officers, that we expand what we fund, train, and are prepared to do with responding to calls that aren't just sending an armed officer. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. In fact, we had discussed that in terms of being part of our proposals, but since the PAB was working on it, we decided to do that later on or to support those who are working on it.
Okay, but you endorse that kind of a call, yeah.
Oh, I definitely endorse that because the whole Daniel Prude situation would have been treated, had a different outcome if that was in place.
Okay. PAB also says no more using tear gas, those kind of canisters we saw deployed during the demonstrations this past summer in downtown Rochester, essentially ever. No more using those kinds of materials and agents. What do you think?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot now, Evan.
So the bottom line is that's not part of your proposal, I guess. That's not something.
That's not part of our proposal at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
All right, that's...
I think in certain situations where you have armed insurrection and things of that sort, I think tear gas canisters are necessary. But in terms of regular protests and things of that sort, I think we should wait and see on that one.
It sounds to me, Reverend, let me ask all three of you for thoughts on this then. It sounds to me like the debate in this country, especially since the killing of George Floyd, has focused on how much we rely on police, what we ask police to do, how we train police, and what our expectations are. And, you know, for some who have called for saying, hey, you know, you shouldn't have armed officers in certain situations, or you shouldn't have military tactical gear coming from the Pentagon. You shouldn't be using pepper spray or tear gas ever. It sounds to me that you are more saying, Reverend, and tell me if I'm wrong here, that you don't oppose police working in every community in the country. You don't oppose police even having some of these agents and materials for extreme situations, but you're concerned that they've been trained to think of almost, well, way too many situations as warfare, as ones in which they should turn to force first or be violent or deploy some of these things, that there must be better training from the get-go, better recruitment, better training to give you a chance to only use force, to only use those items of force or chemical agents, et cetera, when it is wise and prudent to do so. And so far, you think that it is often not wise and prudent when they've been deployed. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. I don't think it was wise and prudent to use it with the Black Lives Matter demonstrations here in Rochester.
Sure.
It was not wise at all. But it's wise and prudent to use it in certain situations.
Like last Wednesday at the Capitol?
Yeah, like at the Capitol where there's deadly force involved.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with that.
And then just generally in terms of policing. I mean, you don't want to tear down police forces to the studs and start over, but you certainly sounds like you want to tear down training and start over. Tear down the expectation for officers.
Yeah, I think training needs to be restructured. I think we need to re-envision and reinvent what training should look like with police. And that's the only way we can get to dismantling the warrior culture.
Okay. Reverend Wilson, how do you see the overall mission, especially when it comes to changing the culture? What do you think the hardest, you know, sort of piece of all this to change is?
I think the hardest piece is going to be the old way, or the old order of doing things. And the reimagination, we're going to have to reimagine doing public safety, law enforcement, in a very radical different way. So that is going to mean that there are going to have to be some radical changes around, you know, how we do our education, how we do the training, different reforms around de-escalation, being and implementing things like the pre-arrest diversion programs, allowing for there to be more community input, more community and just better community police relations overall. Those are very radical changes that are going to have to take place, but they have to be done. And I just think it's the old order is very stifling. And I think there's going to have to be that conversation around institutional and structural racism. And it's going to have to be a very blatant, open conversation.
Okay. Frank, what do you think the hardest piece to change will be?
I'm thinking about the internal discipline that needs to go on within the police department. The reason I say that is that I believe we can do all the training that we're talking about, all that we're talking about adding, about the escalation, about racial justice, and we can also have all the right policies and procedures in place. Question is, what happens when that doesn't happen? What happens when an officer still does something or fails to do something that is really outrageous and harms the community? Is there a will within the police department to discipline its own people? Because right now that doesn't exist. And right now we have a police accountability board that does not have teeth. And even the monitoring that we're attempting to do has no real basis for being enforced at all if we object to something that's happening. So ultimately it comes, and then we come to the union and the place that the union has in interfering with that discipline.
That is a series of vital points that Frank just made. And after our only break of the hour, we're going to get into that. You have to have, you cannot have reform without at least a mostly willing set of reformees, of police departments willing to change their policies. And you probably need city government to be involved and to give it the thumbs up. There has to be a partnership here, because otherwise reforms aren't going to do anything. And we've seen decades of attempted reforms do very, very little in substantive change in this community. And that's why I asked right at the outset, I mean, how do you get this stuff to take hold? So we'll do that when we come back here with Reverend Lewis Stewart, Reverend Wanda Wilson, Frank Starpoli from United Christian Leadership Ministry, talking about their police reform proposals on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, impeachment will move forward in Congress this week, even though it's highly unlikely that there could be impeachment and conviction before a new president, President-elect Biden, is inaugurated. So what does it mean going forward? What would impeachment mean if it didn't pick up until 3 or 4 months into a new Biden administration? What are the ramifications? We'll talk all about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So before we get back to some of your feedback and phone calls, this is a community that has tried police reform many times. And some of our listeners have asked about whether the city government's going to be involved and even accepting of it, given the fact that you've got the former police chief, Laron Singletary, who is very, very not just upset with city government, but making allegations, for example, suing the city government, saying Mayor Warren told him to lie about the Daniel Prude case, and that, you know, city government is not going to be amenable to these changes if the former police chief is correct here. And that he's going to try to prove in court that he was told to lie about this. Reverend Stewart, are you concerned about that?
Well, yes, I am. I am concerned about that. But I think city government is amenable to it, because I am on the mayor's executive order 203, which is not her executive order, but it's the executive order mandated by the governor to come up with these proposals and recommendations to be implemented and be on his desk by April the 1st. So I think the city government is amenable to it. I think the mayor is certainly involved in leading this effort to reform of policing in Rochester. And so that is moving forward. We have this other group, Wilmer Hale, that the city paid some money to look at the police culture, police procedures and policies, and to make recommendations. I'm meeting with them this week. So, and we have other groups like RAISE and the PAB, which are all working together under the umbrella or the aegis of the city to try and make these changes. So I think the city has to make these changes. All municipalities have to make these changes, or else they're going to be deprived of the funding that they need. I think that's the lollipop that's being extended to them. Other than that, I certainly believe that the city and city officials, city council is firmly behind these proposals and these recommendations being implemented.
How seriously do you take former Chief Singletary's allegations about the mayor?
Well, I really can't answer that. All I do know is that, and the others can tell you, we sat with Chief Singletary on a quarterly basis, and usually relative to the body worn camera situation. And he did not breathe one word about what had taken place with Daniel Prude during that time that we sat with him and worked on body-worn camera policies and implementation. Not one word. He's very closed-mouthed about it. So that is something I really cannot speak on.
Okay. Reverend Wilson, you want to add to that?
No, I just go with what Reverend Stewart said.
Okay. Frank, any concern that city government, whether it's the mayor or otherwise, will resist change?
Well, I think it's natural to resist change, but I have to say that in the process of putting these proposals together, we had 7 or 8 current or former law enforcement leaders working with us on these proposals. These are folks who understand that serious reform is needed. They're engaged. They're affirming the direction that we're heading in. And so that gives me a lot of hope. And I know that UCLM for a long time has had, as you said before, good relationships with many of these leaders. And there is with them, as there is with us, this sense that you talked about before, this is a moment. This is a moment when it actually might happen. And so I'm encouraged by that.
Well, and so to Frank's point, Jim in Rochester, hang on the phone for one more second. To Frank's point, let me ask Reverend Stewart and Wilson. Reverend Stewart, Frank is also pointing at police unions as being resistant to change. And in this community, we know that the police union has defended how officers behaved on the night that Daniel Prude was killed, that the police union has said that they are trained well and that they all follow their training. Is the union going to be an impediment to change, Reverend Stewart?
Yes, the union is going to be an impediment to change. Presently, it's suing the city and the governor about transparency relative to 50A because it does not want the files of police officers released to the community. So that indicates to me how intransigent police unions are, especially the Locust Club. I think the Locust Club, they will say one thing that we need change, etc., but in terms of their actions, they will stick to the old club, the old way of doing things, the old culture. And certainly Mike Mazzeo knows that things need to change, but Mike and the others in the police club, they are the ones, they are the very impediment to change itself. And so though they are part of police culture. When we say go, they say stop. When we say up, they say down. And so they are always going to defend the police actions and police policies and procedures and the way the police do things, always.
Reverend Wilson, what do you think?
Yes, I do believe they're going to be a hindrance. And again, I would take it back to, you know, because this would be a structural change for them. It would be a difference in the old order and how things are done. It would be perceived by them as losing power. And when you're being threatened about losing the power and control, you're going to be resistant around the change.
Let me get Jim in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Jim.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
Good, sir.
I want to make a point. It might sound a little scary. You know, I was in the Navy for a long time, and it took me and my training about 2.5 years to get out and actually work and operate. I've been in anti-war activism and social justice activism for a long time. A lot of friends and I in the community have been talking about further militarizing the police, not in the sense in weaponizing them, but just giving them diligent training, you know, years of training before they can actually go out and operate and do their job. Because what they are getting isn't adequate, and the workload they're getting, you know, I'm not a big supporter of police, but I believe that it's not fair that, you know, these people are not equipped to handle mental health calls. You know what I mean? So I think it would be paramount to increase the training budget. And, you know, that's about all I have.
Okay. Jim, thank you. Reverend Stewart, you want to start? What do you think?
I agree with Jim in the sense that the training budget does need to be increased. He hit the nail on the head. The fact is, and that's why we've always pushed for a reallocation of police resources instead of defunding of police resources. Also, he said something else is the fact that police are inadequately trained to deal with mental health services. Police do not need to deal with mental health interventions. That is not their job. That is not their role. And that's why we've had so many problems relative to that, relative to the Daniel Prude case and other cases in that sense. So I totally agree with Jim. I just want to thank him for his comments.
All right, let me get some more feedback via email for all of our guests. Nathan says, Evan, wouldn't it be better if we just had one metropolitan police force, one standard for training for all? Both as a taxpayer and a citizen, wouldn't such a plan make more sense than handling matters piecemeal? As for being defunded, isn't the more appropriate way to look at it as having the police be right-sized based upon the police forces in similar-sized municipalities? Surely the economics would be better and the training and expectations of officers be standardized as a result. That's from Nathan. And Nathan may be referring, Reverend Stewart, Nathan may be referring to the fact that the Police Accountability Board says that in their study of similar-sized cities across the country, Rochester has roughly twice the amount of police officers on their force as others. That they didn't come out overtly and say, therefore, cut it in half or, you know, reduce the numbers. But the right. PAB is saying, we got a lot of officers compared to a lot of cities. And Nathan is saying, would you call it right sizing as opposed to defunding? Reverend Stewart, do you, let's kind of work backwards in his email. Is there something to that, or are you not thinking that part of the goal should be reducing the number of police officers?
Well, I'm not thinking that. What I'm thinking about is better training for police officers, and there's always been the vision of a metropolitan sized police force. Anyway, the third thing I wanted to comment on is the fact that we don't have a federal standard for policing. All police agencies have different standards. There are certain standards that you have to basically be in alignment with in New York State. But other than that, there are different standards in training. There are different standards in policies and things of that sort. So I would like to see a standardized way that the police will do the business and conduct themselves. But at the same time, there might be a pathway to maybe reducing police force. I think our police force right now is about maybe a little over 700 people, with 93% of them residing not in the city but in the county. So there are certainly some things to look at, but I think the Metropolitan Police Force has been an idea that was looked at when Bill Johnson was
yes,
mayor.
Sir.
In the city. Do you remember that?
Absolutely. And lots. And when he ran for county executive, he talked about those kinds of ideas.
Yep.
and was frankly, he encountered a lot of heat for it.
Yep. He encountered a lot of heat for it. And there's a lot of impediment to that by town and city supervisors, et cetera. So that's not an idea that's really going to get off the ground right away.
Yeah.
But in terms of better training, yes, we are for that. We definitely support that.
Reverend Wilson, here's an email from Kevin in Orchard Park. He says, studies have shown that racial bias training does little to change behavior in the long term. How will it be more effective with police? What do you think, Reverend Wilson?
Well, first, I guess my response would be is it would depend on the type of racial bias training that is being offered.
Yes.
And what is the content of that training? So I think that's important to take a look at. But I do think it's needed along in addition with, I think that we would have to incorporate and go back and do some history. I uplift this to say that the foundation of policing and law enforcement, those elements have to be incorporated along with that type of training for it to work.
Okay. And Reverend Stewart, it sounds like you're agreeing with that. It sounds like at least you think not all training is the same. Not all quality of training is the same.
Right, right. And I like his comments, and I like Pastor Wanda's comments too, because some studies have indicated and shown that certain types of implicit bias training doesn't change anything in terms of police behavior. But Pastor Wanda is right. It's the content of that training. And not only is it the content of that training, but the subject matter of that training, and also the experiential way and innovative ways of doing training that are necessary to change hearts and minds. And so not only do we have to change how officers perceive things, but we also have to change behavior. And you can't be change behavior not unless you get to changing people's hearts and minds. And so that's where our training, the racial justice education training, is going to be different, because we want this training to engage in simulation. We want this training to engage in changing the direction of policing and also dismantling the culture. And this is going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of time, but I'm hopeful that we can achieve this.
Yeah, Frank, I know, Frank, you've spent a lot of time thinking about how minds are changed and how people, you know, will take new information or ideas. And to the email's point, there has been some criticism in the last couple of years about how training's been done and whether or not it produces results. Now, I'm certainly open to the idea that your colleagues have brought forward, Frank, which is that you can do this better, that it not all trainings are the same here. Does it worry you, Frank, that historically we haven't seen a whole lot of, the results that maybe you'd hope for in such trainings?
Well, it does worry me in the sense that here's what I see. I have seen a lot of dreadful training go on. I've probably done some dreadful training myself. But much of the training that goes on about diversity and inclusion is, I would say, wimpy. The curriculum that we have put together is 33 pages. This is copyrighted now. We have not published this. It was put together by a group led by Reverend Norm Roberts, and they consulted with Dr. Todd Smith at RIT. It's a very professional, well-done curriculum. And that, too, could fail unless it's backed up by ongoing education, by supervision, by retraining, et cetera, et cetera. It's not about the curriculum. It's about what happens when that officer gets back out on the street and starts to interact with people.
Let me squeeze in some more feedback for our guests from United Christian Leadership Ministry, who've been talking to us about their proposals for police reform in Rochester. Listener says, Evan, I would prefer that my name not be said on the air. I'm retired from a 35-year career in probation and parole. Based on my experience, it is my opinion that the militarization of police accelerated after the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Not long after that, the warrior cop mentality began to permeate the ranks and training of parole officers and then probation officers. In required trainings that I attended, the message given to parole officers is that their number one job was to not get injured or killed. After the merger of parole into the New York State Department of Corrections in 2011, the us against them, because they all want to kill us mentality, seemed to be firmly taking hold. The ancillary peace officer agencies in New York State, like community supervision, should also be looked at for change in training and culture. That's from a listener who asked that his name be withheld. So, Reverend Stewart, again, I know you're focused on, for example, the Rochester Police Department. This listener is saying that this culture has extended beyond police departments, and I wonder at least if you agree with that assessment of it.
Yes, I do. Being a former prison chaplain, I've seen this extended to probation as well as parole. And certainly this is a part of the culture that has to be broken down. There's an us versus them mentality. There is the police being seeing themselves as the good guys and seeing black and brown people as being the bad guys, as being the enemy. There are also some stereotypical perceptions of black and brown people as being violent, as being criminal, or as leaning towards that very heavily. And so these are the perceptions, the cultural animosity that exists within police culture itself that has to be deconstructed and rearranged. Yes, I agree with the comments coming from the person there.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Let me get Cameron in Rochester on the phone. Last comment from a listener. Go ahead, Cameron.
Hi. I'm kind of late in the conversation. I heard everything you guys are saying. I'm also a Marine Corps vet too. I just kind of finished off my whole entire career this past September. My question is kind of within the piece that I feel like is missing a lot of the police reforms that I'm hearing. It talks nothing about getting the cops back actually into the community when they're not doing their jobs, like letting them actually do better. So, like, I work for a city of Rochester in the youth department. We just had the Shop with Cops event. That's a cool event and all, but that's not enough. With law enforcement officers so far that we've talked to, would love to be doing more interaction with our kids and our youth. Now, I'm only going to say this because everybody's kind of brought the military stuff in this here. The children of a lot of the battle spaces we were in when we were overseas, we were also very, very engaged with the community and the locals.
Hmm.
Very much engaged. I lived in Afghanistan with Afghanis. I didn't live with them on base. So it was different. It's drastically different when you're not patrolling and treating them like it's my job. It's just me patrolling.
Mm-hmm.
I know this kid. I know these people. I know this community. There are several cops that are working in Rochester that are, like, in the households. And these dudes are dope because the kids know them and respect them. But it's not enough of that. And they can't get out and do their jobs and do that part of their job that I feel is probably the most important, knowing the kids. You just can't get out and do it at this point.
And, Cameron, I got to give our guests time to respond, but I'm really grateful for your phone call, and thank you for your service. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us on this. Reverend Stewart, really interesting stuff from Cameron there. Go ahead.
Let me answer that. The police officers that deal with kids, that's well and fine. Those are good optics. And also the fact that some of the police are very concerned about youth. But by and large, what we have to do is change. That doesn't change police culture. That does not change the way police operate in communities of color. It does not change police policies and procedures that tend to be racist, that tend to be inhumane, that tend to want to arrest people of color and disrespect people of color. And so, yes, at some point for optics and feeling good, yeah, we can deal with kids and teen empowerment and things of that sort. But what we've got to do is change police culture, policies, and procedures.
And, Reverend, 20 seconds. I just got to stick this in there as the music plays.
Yes.
We're out of time, but 20 seconds. He's saying he lived in the community in Afghanistan with the Afghanis. He got to know them. Do we need more officers living in the community they serve?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Yes, we do.
Okay. So that could be part of conversations and proposals as well. Reverend Stewart and Wilson, Frank Starpoli from United Christian Leadership Ministry, a leading voice in this community calling for police reform, very specific with your proposals. Let's stay on this and let's keep engaging the community. And thanks to all of you for being with us.
Thank you, Evan, for all you're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And Reverend Stewart, again, I know helped round this up. We always appreciate you, sir. Thank you. More connections coming up in just a moment.